For May 17th, 2013, we have a rerun. Hey, everybody, this is Cole. So this takes some explanation. We had some difficulties with scheduling this week, and we were not able to record an entirely new show of the level. Rather than leave you hanging for 2 weeks straight, I decided to kind of dig back into the archives and do something I've wanted to do kind of for a while, which is identify some of the old spoiler casts that we used to do about specific games. This was kind of the precursor to the bonus levels that we've done. Think Walking Dead, think Spec Ops. Those are real popular. So if you like those, we've talked about, you know, a couple of games kind of in that same vein, kind of like, you know, all gloves thrown away to the side, you know, no holds barred. How many holds barred? None holds barred. There are like probably like three or four of them. So going, you know, kind of chronologically, the first one that I want to bring up here, the one that you're going to hear this week, is the episode that we recorded about Heavy Rain. This was a game that, we all really, really enjoyed when it came out and, you know, kind of informed some of our discussion about, you know, the nature of, emotionally affecting games or how storytelling is used in games in different kind of unexpected ways. And I feel like it's important for you to hear it. So some things to note, you know, our recording circumstances were different, and it sounds really, really bad. I apologize for that, but that's the way that it goes. We only were recently able to afford better recording equipment. Additionally, you know, since we are doing, you know, it's a spoiler cast, if you haven't played Heavy Rain, I recommend that you beat it before you listen to what we have to say about it. It is a good game. It's very flawed, but we felt it necessary to talk about it. So, you know, take that as you will. That'll pop on after the music here. Something I want to say before we go, this was announced kind of across the entire network, but specifically on Watch Out for Fireballs, we're doing a Kickstarter to do a live show. I won't go through the whole spiel here, but if you want to find out more, go to duckfeed.tv/Kickstarter. That will redirect you to our project page. And there you can find out details about what we have in store and find out how you can contribute to make something really, really awesome happen. The campaign has been, you know, online for about a day or so, and we're almost to that goal. But, you know, we don't want that to discourage you from going after, going after any of the rewards or the donation tiers. We have stretch goals in mind and more things that we would like to do given the resources that that you can provide us. So yeah, check that out. That's duckfeed.tv/Kickstarter. We really, really appreciate it. Help us do a live show and also do more awesome stuff from WAF and the network. So yeah, brief break, and then we're going to talk about Heavy Rain.
Discussion. And now we're on to the very special portion of this show. I don't have any name for it because it's kind of different from what we've done in the past, but it is a very spoiler-filled discussion of the video game Heavy Rain, put out on the PlayStation 3 by Quantic Dream earlier this year in 2010. It's a fantastic game, very cinematic, very much akin to the old adventure games of yore that I personally am fond of to a great degree. But if you haven't played this game, then I would recommend that you stop listening, actually. And this isn't one of those jokey, you know, stop listening things like, haha, we're alienating our audience. Trust me, we don't have to try to do that. We do it automatically. but yeah, I mean, this is where we're kind of going to discuss our shared experiences with it, because this is one of those games, those few games that all of us have played through at some point over the past couple months. So I think that it'll be very fruitful to discuss. And I think we should lead into this by... Well, Ben, you had a question for us.
What did you guys cut off Ethan's finger with?
I did the knife because it was right by the stove with the rebar.
Is that? I remember I had like a hatchet-like device.
I think there is a hatchet you can
use. There's an axe, yeah.
I think I used the axe. I can't remember where in the room it was.
That might be like one of the right choices.
They're all right choices.
Well, yeah, but I know that at least to get the trophy, you have to...
The gold finger?
Is that the name of the trophy?
Yeah. This one, yeah.
You have to choose the one that you could, you know, you whack it off, with one smooth motion rather than, you know, having to go at it like with the shears or whatever. Yeah. Then you disinfect it, then you cauterize it.
Oh dude, when I did that, I literally was out of my chair hopping around with Ethan. Like, I was so freaked out by that.
Well, it's funny because it's one of the most memorable scenes of anybody that I talk to about it. That is what comes up the most, is that particular thing. And I think what's so compelling about that, I'm sorry, I hate the word compelling, it's another one of my bad words, but and it gets so much better when I draw attention to it. No, but what's so compelling about that scene is you are controlling him every single step of the way. And I can't think of the last time that a video game brought out that much empathy in me. You know, I mean, you know, at least in the way that I played it, I kind of felt exactly what he was going through. It's kind of like, oh, God, no. You just kind of like, it's kind of like watching somebody get hit and then hit in the nuts on YouTube. You know, you kind of wince in sympathy pain. And this is remarkable because this happens with Ethan, even though Ethan is made out of polygons, a lot of polygons, but polygons nonetheless.
I think 90% of it was how well it was voice acted. Like, the way he reacted...
Frenchly?
Yeah. But the way that Ethan reacted to getting the tip of his finger knocked off and the sounds he made were, you know, made it very, very, very uncomfortably real for me.
A lot of screams.
That was, you know, if you want to talk about horrifying, you can talk about watching Saw or something like that, and those are all horror movies. But the sounds that I heard and what I saw during that scene were truly horrifying. And even I can feel myself right now, even just talking about it, like my shoulders were all tense all of a sudden because that was so traumatic.
It's very evocative. And I think that it's funny because no matter what you do, Ethan ends up with an injured arm.
Yeah, if he doesn't cut off his pinky when they go out in the alleyway, the cop shoots him.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But I think that gets to the heart. I mean, I don't want to draw too many broad conclusions about the game right now, but it doesn't excel at giving you a lot of choice. It gives you a lot of opportunity to shape your experience, which is different from having an actual outcome on the consequences of the game, but you are given your own, you're given a feeling of agency over what's happening. And the game is not so much like an interactive movie or whatever. It is a way to deliver emotions to the viewer.
Yeah, it's almost like the experience is like if you take a row of rooms, you know, and you have freedom to walk around in the room wherever you want to go. But you have to go to the next room after you're done. You know what I mean? Like, that's pretty much what the experience is like.
Yeah, and that says a lot to the general structure of the entire thing. I think that as a whole, maybe the narrative is a little bit squeaky because there's not an awful lot of logic from beginning to end, except in certain cases with the reveal of, you know, everything like that. But there's a lot of red herrings that are given up. And the points of articulation where all of it kind of meets together and, you know, you're forced into a way that the narrative arc is going to go. But the brilliance is in how each of those individual scenes play out.
So help me with this, because I really did not come away from the story with a lot of qualms with it. Overall, you know, in thinking back on it now, I was very happy with the way the story played things out and left things for me at the end. And keep in mind, I am the one who played through it once in one continuous motion, no restarting, and then went back and played, I think, two different scenes a couple of times. I replayed the psycho guy who had all the crosses in his room to see what would happen if I didn't shoot him, because the first time through I did. I freaked out and I shot him. And I'd love to talk about that and some other scenes more later. But then the other scene that I replayed was, towards the end, just trying some different combinations of, you know, Madison living or dying. Because for me, Madison died in the fire, in the house fire.
How did she die?
Sadly, it came down to a mechanical failure on my part. I was walking through, I believe the second room that you get into. I think it's the bedroom. Or no, excuse me. I had gotten out of the bedroom into the main room.
The living room, yeah.
Yeah, and was trying to find my way to the door. Because the one thought in my head was, get to the door, the front door that I had come in. And, you know, if you step on the flames, your pants or whatever catch on fire and you have to shake the controller to put them out. And even though I was shaking as vigorously as I could, I guess it just wasn't enough. and she burned to death in front of my eyes. And that was one of the moments. Again, there were so many moments in this game where I was literally standing up out of my chair watching the TV. But that was one of them, because I had committed at the beginning when I started the game, I'm not going to do any restarts. I'm not going to play anything over. And when she died, I was beside myself. It really felt like a loss. Yeah, I was absolutely beside myself. In a way that I've never been for a movie or a book or anything like that. And I think this was the new emotion that, because, you know, I've been moved by movies and stuff before. But the new emotion that came along with all of this and with all the times that I failed in one way or another was guilt.
I am responsible for this.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on the way that guilt factored into this, because I did, like you said, I felt incredibly responsible for everything that happened, good or bad, and I've never felt that way about a movie or a book or any other medium that I can think of.
I would say, yeah, I think I had a similar experience to what you did, where I shot Nathan, I believe that was the yeah, I shot him well before I should have, and so I think the next day I went back and change that, because I felt responsible for, you know, flipping out early and shooting this guy, because it was, you know, because immediately after you kill him, you know, like, then Blake is just like, oh, whatever, you know, like, and like, you're totally like, I should not have even cared about saving this guy, you know, like, I've made a huge mistake.
No, that's one of those things I was going to comment to the effect of, I didn't feel guilty about it. I felt guilty at the time because I killed somebody, and that doesn't seem like something that Nauman would do. But,
Nauman.
I'm Nauman Jaden. but, no, I mean, just like, as you go on and you find out that Blake is kind of a douche nozzle, it's kind of like, why did I shoot somebody to save you? I should have let him cut you to pieces with his cross or whatever.
I'll tell you what is it that really did affect my psychology, because up until that point, I'd played very much in character with Jaden, in that I really tried to maintain a good relationship with Blake, and you know, I tried, you know, I'm a criminal psychologist. I have to be good at psychology. I should know how to deal with people who aren't the most pleasant in the world. But after that shot, it literally changed me, and I blew up at Blake every single chance I got. It was, I hated him. And it, regardless of whether or not it was beneficial to what I was trying to do with the story, you know, whatever control I had over it, whenever there was an option to blow up at Blake, I blew up at him.
And what's funny is Nauman doesn't, and none of the characters, they act according to the way you feel. You know, I mean, you're given a couple of different options, you know, based, you know, how they're going to act out. But specifically with Nauman, you have an opportunity to either, you know, say, you know, you should probably shouldn't be roughing up the suspect, or, you know, things like that. Or you can be complicit in it the entire time. And that's entirely dependent on how you're on which choices you act.
And there's a scene where you can go even so far as to hitting Blake, you know, like punching him, you know, like,
I think, you know, for what you mentioned earlier about, you know, they really do kind of restrict how far you can stray, but there are so many permutations that I haven't even considered, because it's a change upon a change upon a change that I never made that first change, so I can't know about any of the others. That's kind of cool. None of the versions I played had Ethan getting arrested.
There's an entire scene where if he gets arrested, you can lead, you play as Nauman and you break him out. So it's kind of like a get out of jail free card, you know.
And that probably never comes up in the plot again, like, yeah, you know, like Nauman doesn't get like reprimanded for it or
That it's very self-contained scene. Yeah,
which is funny because like none of the characters are held accountable for any of their multiple felonies committed.
Well, you know it's okay, that phone told you to.
Never mind the fact that that Madison, if you play her a certain way, comes across at least three other serial killers in her pursuit of the origami killer.
There wasn't always the best writing or acting, but I completely forgive Heavy Rain for all of that.
You know, it's funny because as a video game, it's a shitty video game, and as a movie, it's a 10-hour long snooze fest. But as something in between, it's fantastic. It at least is good enough to warrant us talking about it, right?
Yeah, it's just, it's all over the place in quality. Like, you know, like with voice acting and writing in general, you know, like there's some scenes where it's just like laughable, like the writing and the voice acting, especially by like the kid voice actors, you know, and it's just like, we need to get to my dad, you know, and it's like, all right, whatever.
Let me ask you guys that then. When was the first time, like you said, Cole, as a video game, as a movie, as whatever the hell this was in between, holy cow. When was the first time that you really realized, wow, I've got something completely different on my hands playing this game?
I think ever since I saw the demo of the game, I felt like it was something that looked completely unique, you know?
So you had high expectations going in?
They were pretty up there, and I was pretty pleased with it, too. I think... When I knew I was playing a really good game was about maybe before the last like set of chapters, you know. So maybe right before Madison finds out who the killer is, you know. Like that's where I was completely 100% into the story, you know. I wanted to know who the killer was. I wanted to know how all the storylines were going to resolve. Like the stakes were so high and it was so like I was so into it, you know. Like it did a really good job of drawing you in the first time you play, I think.
So, how about you, Cole?
For me, I knew a lot about the plot going in, or at least the way it was set up. I didn't particularly know about the trials. That was something that was kind of left unspoiled for me. But it was impossible for me not to know about the Jason scene. It was kind of like, it's just one of those things that you knew about. And I kind of got into it, and I really liked the opening sequence with him in the house and things like that. We'll get back to that. But even though I knew that Jason was going to die, and in fact, I thought that at the beginning that Jason was the one who got killed, and then you were acting as Ethan to, you know, find, like, I thought that Jason dying was the ultimate thing that set off all the events of the story, right? But that scene where you're in the mall and running through the crowds of people and it's just like totally terrifying, and you have this kind of helpless flailing that you can do with calling out his name, as hilariously badly acted as it is, it's so tense. And even though I knew that Jason was gonna die, I still was pressing that button to my heart's content and pushing people down, trying to find him, thinking that there might be something I can do to save him. Even though I knew there was no victory condition, which games need to have, that particular scene, there's no way to win it. There was something, you know, call it, you know, the Papa Wolf instinct, where, you know, to not want to see a child harmed or whatever. And we can have a whole big discussion about how Heavy Rain is very generational, in that the people who initially played video games, or at least people in our subset, are old enough to start, you know, being dads or whatever. You know, it's like that is the integral relationship at the heart of this, which is the relationship of the father to the son and the son to the father. Right. And that particular scene, and then the later scene that echoed it in the train station, just that helplessness, knowing you couldn't win, but trying very desperately to win. Quite frankly, it was irrational behavior, but it drew me into the world and drew me into the relationship and the values that this game was going to set forth, which was, as a father, what will you do to save your son? I think that's the tagline of the game or whatever, but it's apt.
So for me, the moment that I realized, you know, I had something different, was that the tutorial, if you can call it that, for the fight sequences, where you're doing the quote-unquote sword fight with your son.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just churning through these button prompts like, oh, yeah, I got this down. Okay, react, react, react. And then I saw the look on my son's face.
And you were beating him senseless?
I'm beating him senseless with a toy sword. I feel like such a jerk. And from that, like, I intentionally lost from that point on. You know, I threw in one or two ones that I got just so it would be a fair fight or whatever, but I intentionally lost that fight. I'm curious, did you guys lose that fight, quote unquote, or did you beat him up?
I won it. I had no I had no compunction about it.
What does he do?
No, he just kind of like, oh, I did, like, he doesn't even really remark on it, but he just kind of reacts like, oh, my dad's a hero. He's so, you know, whatever, you know. He doesn't actually say that, but that's the sense. Like there's no like, oh, you know, he runs crying to mommy because daddy's being a meanie.
See, I was legitimately worried that's what was going to happen, because I had read, the one thing I knew is that you had chances to be a bad dad.
The first time I played it, I threw the fight as well. Because, you know, like, you hit him in the face one time and it's like, oh man, he's really going for it. So Yeah. So I totally took a dive the first time. Then the second time I played it, I won. You know, like since the
I loved the change in tone from the prologue segment, basically everything before Jason's death to after Jason's death, because I knew from the promo material that everything's gonna be real dark and grainy and realistic and things like that. But when the sun rises on this game, you're in this idyllic saccharine, too happy to live IKEA catalog household. You know what I mean? And you know, your biggest concern is, you know, I need to do some work. Although I tried to find the work, but I never found any work. All I did was drink some orange juice and watch some TV. And I think that some of my favorite segments, at least of the setup, were everything before Sean was kidnapped, where like it forced you to go through the daily routine. Yeah. And it's kind of like, I put a lot of effort into making sure he got to bed on time. Uh-huh. And I tried to, you know, I tried to be the good dad in the park. And, you know, even though they were obviously so just racked with just despair at their situation, and Ethan was living in a shitty apartment, and it was really it was something that I was invested in a lot, and it was very poignant. I knew that by, you know, having me throw the boomerang or whatever, even if it was a protracted tutorial, you know, everything that I was doing to increase that bond with my son, I knew that it was leading up to, okay, Sean's going to be one who's kidnapped, and then that's going to lead to the entire investigation. But there was a lot that had to do with that, and there was a distinct change in tone from this idyllic sun-soaked world to when the rain really starts. How did you guys feel once you figured out what the inches below the time and day stamp were? Because, you know, it says like Monday, and then it says like two and a half, and it's like, oh really, what?
Yeah
At first I thought that was just like the game's thing, and then I was like, oh, this is seconds ticking off of my son's life.
Yeah, and you don't figure that out until Norman comes in and explains the origami killer's MO, right?
Yeah, what's to do with French people not being able to pronounce origami?
They mangled it so much. I was just like, oh gosh, you're not making my job easy here. Origami killer, really?
It actually, I hated the inches measurement once I figured out what it was, because it told me how much time I had left in the game. Like, I was like, ah, oh, I'm coming up on the end of the game here. I had a very similar moment early in the game where looking back, I totally should have gotten it, quote unquote, using that twice in like the span of 5 seconds, woohoo, but totally should have gotten it early on. But I didn't pursue the train of thought that was so well laid out in front of me, because I didn't put enough faith in the storytelling ability of a video game. So, I didn't catch it the first time, which is when Scott talks to Hooker Lady. What's her name? Lauren. I didn't catch it when Scott talks to Lauren, but the second time when he talks to the 7-Eleven owner and says, hey, you know, I'm a private investigator, and the families of the deceased have hired me to help figure stuff out. At that point, it's been revealed to you that the origami killer targets poor families. And when he said that, it totally clicked in my brain, wait a second, these are all poor families. How can they afford a private investigator for all of this? That doesn't make sense. And it totally, like, I got that clear as day. That does not line up. But I chalked it up to the thought in my head was, man, these stupid video game writers. And I just accepted it from there on out. I totally had it from the beginning, and because I didn't have enough faith that they were actually doing something, and I wrote it off as an error, I cannot claim to be the guy who figured it out ahead of time.
I was going to say that's one wrinkle in the story that I was very impressed by, is that sort of being able to play it a second time and see it from a completely different perspective, where, you know, like, yeah, I mean, the entire game, the first time you play through, Scott's just a nice guy and, you know, like a happy-go-lucky guy trying to help out all these families. And the second time you play through, you realize he's collecting evidence against him and destroying it. Yeah, like... And that's such a great double play, you know, that I haven't seen that like that such so well done in a while, you know.
It's funny because I feel like I'm proud to say I didn't get it until right before it was revealed. I mean, like literally when he was sitting at his desk crying and putting things into the trash can, I didn't know it until like he started burning stuff that I knew that he, like, oh, I helped him get that.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think that means that I'm dense because I got all the clues. I just thought that Blake did it. You know, I was convinced that Blake was the killer because he was because he was so adamant on convicting anybody and not just the right person. But yeah, it did a really good job of obfuscating that, even if it was one of the few plot threads that it really saw through to the very end from the beginning. It did a great job of really keeping you on your toes.
Let me ask you guys about this, because, you know, we talk about plot threads that aren't followed through. The one that really stuck out to me was Ethan's blackouts. He woke up with the origami in his hand, and it never explains why or how. The one explanation I can think of is this, is that he would black out and go visit his son's grave, and that Jason's grave was near, you know, the other child's grave, and that he would, while he was there and blacked out, pick up the origami that the construction owner guy had laid there.
Yeah.
Was it the origami killer? Whoever that was, he would
John
pick up
Shepard.
The origami from the... Yeah. He would... that while he was blacked out, he would be in the same plot, and that's why he had it. But otherwise, it never explains that. And that's... Does that make sense to you guys, my explanation, or am I grabbing at straws?
It's maddening, because I can tell that it is something that they put in at the very... They put in to be an act one twist, like to make you think that Ian is the killer, and almost very accurately to give you the sense that you're playing as the origami killer trying to cover up the evidence, except you are not really keyed into it until you know Shelby starts, you know, capping 18 henchmen. I think that when you hear me complain and say that, you know, certain elements of the plot were half baked or whatever, that was one of the ones that no matter how many mental gymnastics like you just did there, Dennis, I can't explain it other than you know, Scott being the man of means that he is and rich enough to own a warehouse
buy cars.
yeah, and GPS units and being the technological wunderkind to set up, you know, cameras to monitor people, you know. The only reason it was kind of like, it was such a blatant contrivance that they could have explained away so very quickly by having like a barely remembered fragment of Ethan being drugged and left out in the street in this very portentous part of town, which he happens to live in, and, you know, Shelby's brother happened to die in, and things like that, you know. It's like they could have explained it away so very quickly at the end, you know, while leading you to do that. It would still have been a contrivance, but it wouldn't have been something that we're sitting here talking about as a blatant problem with the game.
And even added to that is if you do the ending where Ethan gets arrested and Scott gets away for free, Ethan hangs himself in a jail prison, but then before he does there's a bunch of origami figures over, so apparently, like, he knows how to make origami figures, which furthermore, you know, like, it adds another layer of confusion, you know, because it's like...
So let me ask you this. If someone played through that version of the game without playing any other version, would they end thinking, aha, that's it, Ethan is the origami killer?
No, you still find out that Scott's the killer with Madison. It's just that Ethan gets arrested and convicted since nobody knows that Scott's the killer.
I thought that would be a very interesting way to do the game if they had made it so that some of the endings showed Ethan as the origami killer, and just those who played through it that way the first time would have never found out. So not only does the character not find out who the real origami killer is, but the gamer, him or herself, is actually fooled. And then you would have to find out from other people, no, you got it wrong. I thought that was very interesting, and it doesn't sound like they actually realized that.
And it's a shame, because that kind of seems to be what they were promising at the beginning, that anybody could die, and that it would change the outcome of it. But I think the change of the outcome is different than the killer would be different every time. But it's almost interesting that they would have let you die not knowing who the killer was, and that they always chose to let you know that it was Shelby, because nobody could die until the very end.
So I have a question for you guys. Did you fail any of the trials?
I did not drink the poison the first time through.
I did not drink the poison either.
Neither did I, actually. Does it turn out to be poison? Because I was sitting there, I was going, it's not poison. Duh, that's so not poison. And I still couldn't drink it.
That was the way you justified it to yourself, you monster.
It turns out that it's not poison. You drink it, and then, like, he looks at his clock a minute after he should have died, and he's like, I'm not dead. It must not have been poison.
It was a test of faith, or the power was in your heart all along.
I actually also failed the electricity one, and I expected him to actually die there. And when I you know, got that final animation of him, you know, failing, I was so horrified, because I thought, that's it, he's dead, oh no, I screwed up. And, But then he kind of limped out the door.
I just on my last playthrough through the game, if you go through that scene without being electrocuted even once, he doesn't have any scars on his chest when he goes back to the hotel. Yeah, like, because, you know, normally he has a giant burn mark across his chest that she wraps up. There's nothing there, so she doesn't even wrap it up or anything.
Was it just me, or was crawling through the tunnel incredibly annoying?
Yeah.
I'm going to say that terrified me a little bit.
Yeah, you're claustrophobic?
To a certain degree, I think that I am... it's not so much that I'm claustrophobic, it's that I don't cotton to being lost, and I didn't quite understand the way that the match flame was supposed to work. So it wasn't that the close quarters and the broken glass underneath me were upsetting me. It was that I am in this place where I could potentially go in circles for hours and hours and hours. And that kind of put me out. I mean, that was, you know, not to get back to House of Leaves or whatever, but that's one of the reasons why that is so, why the situation that puts forward is so terrifying to me. It's the being lost without a compass kind of thing.
I got lost in there. But I also had a horrible time making turns at each of the intersections. Like, I'd hold the stick to the right and he'd turn to the left, or I'd hold the stick to the left and he'd turn completely around. So not only that messing with me, but it caused me to get disoriented and lost. And so I spent probably 15 minutes longer in those tunnels than I should have. But for every second I was in there, I refused to do anything more than just barely hold down that R2 button to make him crawl forward. I could not bring myself to do anything more than just very slow, one arm at a time over the broken glass.
I feel like that scene would have been just as effective, or even more so effective, if it was just a straight tunnel and you just had to... I mean, because the maze aspect, I think, kind of got annoying after a while. And, like, the fact that he was crawling on glass kind of became less important. You know, kind of took a backseat to the idea of you need to find your way out of here. You know, like, if they would have just had a straight shot with glass, then the focus would have been on, I need to go over this as slowly as possible as to, like, not hurt my character, you know? But I don't know. That's just my...
The whole thing that made it as scary as it was for me was the overtone that this could be your tomb. And I half expected him to do a cheesy scare where you know, you found the skeleton of another dad who went before you.
Yeah, did you see that? Or
there's... No, I didn't.
There is a person in the tunnels. If you take one of the wrong turns, there's a dead body there, and it's like a dude in a suit. Yeah.
Oh, holy crap.
Yeah, there's a couple of different... If you go down one, there's rats that come out, and there's a couple little things. Yeah. One thing, though, is like, you know, like, how would Scott Shelby orchestrate this tomb, you know, or, like, this broken glass, you know, maze, you know?
How about the drug dealer? Did you kill him?
I did not.
I didn't either.
On later playthroughs, I did.
I couldn't let Ethan kill somebody because I played him as ultimately a decent person, whereas you could probably play him as a complete monster if you wanted him to.
I didn't even take the gun out when he opened the door, you know? Like, I just did not want to be in the situation of killing him, you know?
So that actually kind of makes me think about moments in this game where I did things that I would have rather not done because I was freaked out. For example, the whole shooting Nathan thing the first playthrough. I did that because I was legitimately freaked out. He started doing the whole, I'm sending you back to hell thing, and reached for his wallet. And I was mashing R1, you know, at the beginning of that speech. And I knew that it was against, you know, who I wanted Naaman to be, but I was freaked out. I did the same thing when the car went underwater. You guys played that sequence? I actually escaped the car without getting Lauren out because I got halfway through getting Lauren out and freaked out because I'm like, this car is filling with water. I'm going to die. And I played through under the assumption that any of my characters could actually die at any time, even though that's not true until the very end. But I thought it was true all the way through. So that upped the tensity level for me tenfold. So I freaked out and I left her in there. So I'm curious what, so one, I'm a complete scumbag. Never trust me with your life. Two, I'm just out of curiosity, what happens if she lives?
Usually what happens is she gets sent away on a train before stuff goes down between Scott and everybody else, you know?
And that's real uncomfortable because I assumed that her relationship with Scott was a father-daughter. As opposed to, ultimately, it was romantic and they kissed at the train station. And it was like,
oh, no, don't tell me that.
Yeah. You know, never mind the creepiness of, you know, the fact that he's much older than her and acted very paternalistic toward her. Also, he killed her only son.
That kind of sours a lot of the relationships when you go through on a second playthrough.
And you know, I played Shelby like he was, I said this too much, I played him like he was a cross between the Michelin Man and Jesus Christ himself. So, like, when he started capping people at Rich Dude's house, that was strange for me.
That was just...
I took him to a dark place. I let the rich dude die.
Oh, interesting. I saved him first time I played through.
I saved him. So I think that we should we should draw this towards a close. And I mean, we're kind of approaching beyond truncated episode status here. Oh well, it's an interesting conversation. But just a couple. I don't think that we talked about Madison or Nauman too terribly much. When did you catch on that Nauman was addicted to Ari and not Triptykane?
When you told me. So about 4 months after I played the game,
I never got that any of his symptoms were from Ari, like his nosebleed and everything. I assumed was from Triptykane, but at the same time, in the back of my mind, it was kind of playing around. It's, you know, he might be addicted to the glasses, probably with the piano scene.
Really, what tipped you off there?
Just how vague he was with, I wouldn't indulge in too much. I was like, that's intentionally vague.
Yeah, yeah.
How about you, Cole?
I loved how the butler was just like the bartender from The Shining.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Yeah.
So I mean, that came out, and that made the final investigation so much more tense for me when he was going through his evidence that final time, and the world was kind of getting slowly more and more chaotic. Just kind of like, he kind of got a feeling, and that sealed the deal. If him wandering around in the hotel room and fading back and forth didn't already give you that impression.
Did you see his eyes start to bleed?
No, I never got that far.
Did you see that, Dennis?
No, I don't think I remember his nose bleeding when he was fighting the car dealer dude, but that was just as easily from fighting a car dealer dude.
and the whole Mad Dog thing, I mean, like, one of the big issues with Indigo Prophecy was that they're very tone deaf about racial stereotypes. With their one black character, like, every time he walked around, it kind of had like porno music playing, like, like everywhere he went, it was a walking Motown party.
Nice bass groove. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and he was like definitely the most likable character in the whole bunch. But Mad Dog, when Nauman faces him down, they definitely did a complete 180 from Miles in the first game being likable to Mad Dog being a scary black man. So how about Madison and Ethan? Did either of you bone down?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, for certain.
Why not?
My son's dying. Time for sex.
You know, there's always time for hasty fellatio. I guess the most important question was, did you forgive her once Ethan found out?
Yeah.
I did not.
Ooh.
I guess that's why you got the different ending then, with Madison being separated from Ethan.
Well, no, I got the ending with Madison being separated from Ethan because she burned to death. I'm trying to think of the sequence of events that led me to choose to not forgive her. I think I was just trying to really consider how it would feel if I thought I had one ally and found out that she had ulterior motives.
Ultimately, it didn't feel like a great betrayal that she was a journalist and only with Ethan for the scoop. So that's why I didn't see a problem with forgiving her, because just kind of like, oh, okay, but you're helping me out anyway, so.
Yeah, I guess maybe it tells you something about my opinion of news journalists in general. That maybe it took me to that point.
I thought the interesting thing about Madison's character is she was constantly put in like physical danger, where in like every one of her scenes, you know, like you felt like she was gonna get like date raped or something, you know, like she was in a constant state of about to being objectified or taken advantage of, you know,
or being actively objectified. But when she takes advantage on, or no, takes advantage, sorry, when she takes revenge on Paco and like turns the tables on him, that was a really cool scene. I thought that was well done for as kind of cheesy as the everything leading up to it was.
Or the line, "You go, girl."
So, I mean, it feels like they were almost self-conscious of the fact that up to that point, she was kind of the damsel in distress in a lot of regards.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've got two last things that I kind of want to talk about. I don't want to cut off any further conversation. But first off, what'd you think of the watch?
Of that being like the tip off of...
the big, big clue.
I mean, I thought it was good because it was buried in so many other red herrings that I was okay with that. You know, if that, you know, it wasn't... when you go back and play the game, you know, like there's... You will always get that clue. Like, there's no way around it, you know?
It's one of those things. I think Anton Chekhov, the author, he said once that if you introduce a gun in the first chapter, it's going to be used in the final one. You know, just kind of like, you can't introduce a gun and then not have it be an integral part of the plot, you know? So, like, I kind of had my eye out for that. And the second, you know, when I was going through the Ari footage at the very end of Nauman's fight with the origami killer, that it was kind of like, oh my gosh, Chekhov's gun, right? So I thought that was one of the most well done clues, aside from oh gosh, there was one scene in particular that I want to bring up, kind of if we're talking about red herrings that you only realize the brilliance of later. The typewriter shop. Mm-hmm. Did you guys get all the fingerprints?
The first time I did, surprisingly.
Really?
Yeah. I tried to do it a couple times later, and I couldn't even after that. So,
our internet died, which means that we're going to have to record the end of the show right here. I'm putting Dennis on speakerphone if he picks up.
Yeah, what's up?
Our internet took a shit and died. So.
Oh no.
Yeah. So what we're gonna basically do is we're going to close out the show. That ends our Heavy Rain discussion, unfortunately. So this has been episode number 85 of Stand Under the Don't Tree and Riddle Me This, a very special Heavy Rain discussion. And we're very sorry about the technical difficulties at the end of this, but we hope you enjoyed the discussion of Heavy Rain, even if technical difficulties prevented us from adequately finishing it. So,
God, the time it was time.
No Easter egg. We didn't record anything. This is just me. So good night. Go home.